Welcome to the third in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Montserrat Rosa E. Puch is my guest this week. Montserrat is senior lecturer in Hispanic studies at the University of Kent, and we learn about growing up in Franco Spain, the important role that memory plays in her family. She has very vivid memories from when she was just 2 or 3 months old, and she talks about the way that she and her siblings will often share different recollections of the same events. Montserrat relates the desperate urge she had to leave the village where she grew up, and the way that she was a trailblazer for her family in seeking an education, and how she moved to London and ended up studying for her doctorate. We find out that cinema played a particularly influential role in her childhood, especially the life of Brian. She would often see 3 films in an afternoon, and we talk about the difference between American and European cinema. And then the interview with Montserrat concludes with some very personal insights about the influence of religion in Montserrat's native Catalan, as well as important reflections on the nature of belonging and whether we can ever truly escape our pasts, as well as the concomitant danger of looking back. So join me for the third in my series of nostalgia interviews. I'm Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Montserrat Rosa E. Puch. Well, we're here for number 3 of the nostalgia interviews, and I'm here...
In English. Sounds like Montserrat Rosa E. Puch.
Of course, you're in Hispanic studies, and I was just thinking, I reckon that you are the longest-serving academic member of staff in the school. Would that be right? Because I think you've been here, is it 1995?
That's right.
Is that, remember you telling me once?
Yes.
And I was just thinking yesterday, who has been here longer, you know, that hasn't retired, shall we say?
I don't really know, because, I mean, sometimes I go down the corridor and I just look at all the doors and all this and I actually don't recognize half the people because everybody changes so quickly. Yeah. But in SECO, probably around 10 years. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes. The person who was here when I came was James Fowler.
Oh, he was already here, yeah. I put him down as about 96, 97, but he was here
approximately that sort of time. I don't know whether Anna came first and then he came afterwards, but they are from around that time.
From that period. But I remember I came here in 2004, and what I always remember was meeting colleagues who, in some cases, like Anne Alwis, were new. But I didn't know that because we didn't have a sort of reception to introduce everyone. So I was going to what was then the photo board, and I'd be thinking, and Antonio was one of those, actually, who said, oh, hi, you know, he introduced himself. And I was thinking, who is that person? So I was looking at the board and trying to connect the name to the photograph.
Yes, I thought that was incredibly useful because I'm terrible with faces. I mean, I'm terrible with names. I remember the faces, but I cannot put a name to it. And I used to call it the Hall of Fame. And I always used to go down and look at the Hall of Fame. It was incredibly useful. It's a shame they took it away, actually.
Yeah.
It would be really helpful now because there are so many people who have been appointed recently, and unfortunately, I just don't keep up.
Yeah, so I think that's inevitable, but it's obviously a sign of when you've been in an institution so long that people come and go, and suddenly you realise that you become a veteran. I mean, I feel that. I mean, I remember for years I was the new person in religious studies.
And you feel as though you have to apologise.
Yeah, and suddenly now you realise that people come to you almost as a sort of, you know, for wisdom. And you're thinking, surely not. But you think, well, actually, yeah, I probably have been round the block a few times, so that's for me to do with. Anyway, but tell me a bit about yourself in terms of where you were born and anything about your childhood that comes to mind.
Well, I was born in a city called Girona, which is in Spain, halfway between Barcelona and the French border. I was actually born in the city because it was the only place where there was a hospital. But my family live in a village about 11 kilometers from the city that... at the time had 4,000 or 5,000 inhabitants, and it didn't have really anything. It had a church, it had a couple of primary schools, and that was it. So all my life, everything I had to do, I had to go to the city to get it done. So I went to secondary school in the city because there was no secondary, I mean, there is one now, but obviously there wasn't then. And whenever you had to go to the doctors, whenever you had to do anything, you had to, if there was anything serious, you had to go into the city. So that's what it was. I'm the eldest of 5, 4 girls and a boy. My father wanted a son because he had his business and he wanted a son to run the business. And I would have been very happy to run that business, but obviously it had to be a man. Those sort of things, you know, were very much the case in Spain at the time.
And where are your siblings?
Well, apart from me being here, number two and number three, so my two sisters live in the same village still. My second sister went and lived in Barcelona, and she lived in Andalusia, and then she went back to live with my parents when she divorced, and she remarried. Then my second sister stayed in the village always. My brother lives in Barcelona, and my baby sister, who's not a baby anymore, of course, lives in Barcelona as well.
Yeah, because I've got family in Cardiff, and they've lived in Cardiff all their lives, their cousins, and they don't always see each other all that often, because even though they're only probably a few miles from each other, they're in different parts of Cardiff, and because they all live near, they always think, oh, well, you know, we can see each other anytime, but often it's like years before they connect.
Oh, no, my family is a very close family, and they see each other all the time. So, I mean, for my own children, they have always been closer to the family in Spain than to the family in the UK, because in Spain everything happens. And also my parents' home is like the hub of the family, and everybody gravitates to my parents' home. And it's a big house, and everybody, because now everybody has got very busy lives, it's very nice to go to your parents and like chill, you know. So that's very much. And one of the things that obviously always haunts me is the fact that they are there always, and that I don't. And of course, when I go, it's a big celebration, as if there was something special happening. And in fact, it's not, but it's that kind of thing. But oh yeah, well, you only come for 2 days, and you are the flavor of the month, and then kind of you go.
Yeah, I've always struggled with that idea of whether it's the people or the place that comes first. Mm. You know, so you associate people with places, but if you go to a place and the people that you associate with it are no longer there, there's a very strong sense of displacement that I feel. And I've met people, my old university friends, for example, in a different environment. And of course, you just reconnect. So it's the combination, I think, of a particular time of your life, the people who inhabited the places where you lived, and then how you deal with change.
Yes, I mean, I remember very vividly one occasion going to my primary school, because of course my nieces go to the same school that I had gone to like a million years ago. And of course, since then, when I went, it was a nun's school. It was the nuns of the Immaculate Conception and the Heart, the Sacred Heart. That's right. And so they were displaced, and all those nuns went into retirement, and the monks that were next door took over the school, and now it's a co-educational. And so, just out of curiosity, when they said, oh, are you going to come to our open day, blah blah, I went to see. And it was really a strange feeling, because of course there were no more nuns, there was nobody that I knew, everything had been updated, but the rooms that I remembered as enormous and very high ceilings were tiny little places. And it's amazing how, in a way, it's almost like a letdown, because you have remembered it in your head as how my school was, and then you go in there and you think, actually, it wasn't quite, maybe not quite as horrible. I used to think that it was a horrible school, but I don't know, certainly the proportions were totally different.
Yeah. And absolutely, my sense, going back to my hometown just a few weeks ago, everything was in a different proportion to how I remembered it when I was, you know, 4 years of age. But I went back to my primary school 1992 it would have been, so around a decade after I left there. And some of the same teachers were there, obviously a little bit older. And it was the things that I picked up on. For example, I was very aware of the local accent because people have often said to me that I don't sound like I'm from Cardiff. And yet going back and people I knew and I thought, oh, you know, they sound very clearly from the same part of the world that I'm from. But why do I sound different? But also because I was 10 years old and I just started university, there was a part of me that suddenly felt that I was regressing to that, you know, 9-year-old self, whatever it was, when I left there, and with the same dynamics. And I found it very difficult to know how to pitch the conversation, because the last time I would have seen some of those teachers, I was a little boy, and now I was grown up. So there's a part of me that almost wanted to say, you know, look how I've matured. But of course, when you, you know, at the same time, it just, you know, makes it even more obvious that you're trying a little bit too hard. I couldn't get the sort of arrangement right. I suppose it's the same with students who are taught by a particular professor, and then they do teaching in that same department, and then they have a working relationship with somebody that they used to look up to and call sir rather than by their first name. So it's the same sort of dynamic, but it is very disorienting.
It must be. I haven't been back to my secondary school inside, but I have passed it many times over when I go back. And I mean, it is interesting. I mean, the secondary school was a monk school, but it was in the capital, in Girona. And it was a brand new school at the time, and it was a boarding school for boys. And I remember that quite fondly, because it was the first year that they allowed day students and girls. And when I went to the secondary school, there were 40 boys in my class and 4 girls. And I thought, yes, you know, like, that's okay, I like it. I mean, after having been to a single-only girls' school in the village. Anyway, very soon the numbers have started to even out. But it still looks modern. It's interesting. We used to call it the chicken coop, because it had this, it was like made of these modular things. Made out of concrete that anyway looked like a little bit like a farm. And it still does, but it's not unpleasant.
Yeah. But what about really early memories? Are they school based, or can you remember preschool?
I mean, we've always had this debate, because one of the things that we do whenever I go back to Spain, I meet with my brothers and sisters, and we go out for dinner and we have a great big meal and whatever, drinking, whatever, and we always go back to memories. And that's it's very interesting, because each one of us will bring, do you remember that time, that this and this? And of course, because there are 5 of us, each one's got a totally different version of events, and everybody remembers whose fault it was, or how we got into trouble, or this or this. And quite often, you think, is this really the same event? Because I remember it quite differently. But one of the things that has always been controversial is that my first memory that I have is a memory that I've explained to my parents many times, and they reckoned that I couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 months. Because I remember that I was being carried by my mother up a set of stairs, and I can draw you a picture of what it was like. You were just going up very steep stairs, and there was a wall, and then up at the top there was a light. I remember a window in the shape of this woman, an older woman, who was coming to greet us. And my parents reckoned that was when they took me for the first time to meet my father's grandmother, who died when I was very, very little. But that's the only description that fits. But I remember the light and the shadow. I don't quite remember features or anything. Probably my eyes were not quite working yet. But I do remember that.
Yeah, I've got all these memories of being in rains and getting out of them. And apparently, I don't remember this particular experience, but when I was very young, I was in the pram in the house, and I think my mum had just gone to the toilet and she just left me for a matter of seconds, really. And when she came out, you know, I was actually on the wheel and I was strapped in. So she just could not work out. But I used to do that sort of thing a lot. You know, absolutely. And I sort of wonder, even to this day sometimes, I always feel I'm on the go. I always feel like, you know, it's funny. Like even at the cinema, I'm always sort of fidgeting around. So I think I have that knack. But yeah, so from a very early age, yeah. You know.
But one of the things that I remember as an early memory was that I just wanted to get out of that village. Mm-hmm. I just thought that I just wanted to get out. I found the place incredibly claustrophobic. Everybody had an opinion of what you were supposed to do and how you were. They were supposed to know better than you what you were about and what your life was about. And all that interference I found very, very difficult. And I think that is really what got me to go, because I just wanted to see the world. And by that time, my father was traveling quite a lot internationally for his business, and he was always coming back with stories of places and presents and, you know, things that were different. And I thought, I just got to get out. And I'm so pleased that he did. I mean, only recently, there was a student of ours called George who came to us with us to Cuba. And we made good friends. And I was just talking to him and I said, look, I mean, because we meet up for coffee sometimes. And I was talking to him and I said, well, I'm going to go to my village to see my parents, because I hadn't seen them for quite some time. I said, oh, how exciting. I do love little hamlets, he called it. That's funny. My village is not a hamlet. There's actually nothing there, really nothing. And he said, well, I dare you to take a photograph that is nice and bring it back to me. So I went out into the village with my phone, because I love taking pictures, and to try and find a picture of the village that actually made it look good. And apparently it worked. And it just made me realize how prejudiced I am, because, well, perhaps it's not, I mean, it's not a quaint village by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not too bad, I suppose. It just, to me, it reminds me of all the things I didn't want to be.
And it's what other people appreciate, because when, because I was born in Cardiff, so I took it for granted, but people would always say, oh, it's a beautiful city. And I was thinking, really? You know, yeah. So it's often other people's perceptions of something that then make you think, but what do you see? And then they talk about things like going around the castle. And I think, oh, I've never done that. And you think, but, and that's the absurdity, because they associate all the various tourist things, which, because I'm not a tourist, I don't do. So, but why don't I do that? Yeah, and it's funny what you associate, because I went to Lampeter in West Wales, and I remember a teacher at school who it wasn't one of my teachers, but I heard this from, it may have been, you know, filtered or distorted by some of the other pupils, but because Lampeter was quite far out, you know, I mean, there was no train station there, didn't even have a roundabout in those days, and traffic lights, and, you know, it was sort of very much painted as a sort of, you know, why would you go there? I mean, I had the most amazing time, but in a way I left the city for somewhere very small, and then I think after 10 years I outgrew it. So and I didn't realise it at the time, but looking back, I think I was kind of looking for reasons to get out, and often one of those was cinema. So cinema was literally escapism. Yeah, yes. I had to get the bus, I didn't used to drive, and go down to Swansea or Cardiff, see a couple of films, come back renewed and refreshed, but then I would do the same again, you know, the next opportunity.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, the cinema was, I mean, certainly the thing in Spain. I mean, you've got to remember, I was born during Franco's time, so it was not easy. So the only thing, everything was censored, you can imagine. But the only thing that we did have was cinema. And you just go for these very long sessions with like three films in the whole afternoon, Sunday afternoon. And they give you the propaganda, the dot film, and then they give you the one that you wanted to go for, and you spend the whole day out there virtually. You just go in the afternoon and go back home in the evening, but it was the only way to get out, to go to a place that was allowed. And the thing that I suppose we never appreciated was how much freedom we had, because you know, you just used to go out with your friends since you were very little, and spend the afternoon at the cinema and go and get yourself something to drink or some pastries or something, and then get back home in the evening and you were free. And then when the weather was good, you just go and do the same at the swimming pool. Just get up in the morning, get our sandwiches, get our towel, off to the swimming pool, come back when it gets dark.
It's like so much of life, isn't it? It's structure and balance, that you need sort of routine, but you need to do things that slightly deviate from the routine, but you sort of, you go back into it. It all sort of fits in some way, so you can balance work. And I find that. I go to the cinema a lot more than I used to. But, you know, very strictly, it's an evening thing. So I go rather a lot. But it's, you know, for me, it's sort of compartmentalising it. So, and then you can look forward to it rather than just randomly think, oh, I'll go this afternoon. I wouldn't do that because I'm at work. But, you know, so it, in the right balance, it can be a wonderfully liberating experience.
But, I mean, at least, I mean, in those days, it allowed you to see other worlds because it was such a restricted type of environment.
Can you remember the sort of films you saw? Were they mainly Spanish or Spanish language, or did you see international films?
No, there were American films, and the majority that have been dubbed into Spanish, and the dubbing was horrible. And also, they have been censored, and therefore, for instance, you just see this couple, and they would be looking into each other's eyes, and they would just like be getting close. And when it came to the moment of the kiss, somebody had gone with a pair of scissors, and then the whole thing just went and started somewhere else altogether. So we used to, that was part of the fun. We used to like whistle and shout, and how people were cursing and throwing things in the air and all that kind of thing, and then waiting for the next one. And in some cases, the distortion was so incredible that the films just didn't make any sense at all.
Well, I was talking to somebody once who, I think she was French, this was more than 15 years ago, and we were talking about our love of Woody Allen, and then she was referring to his voice, and as she was describing him, I thought, that doesn't sound like the Woody Allen I know. And, you know, he has a very distinctive voice, and of course she'd only ever heard Woody Allen being dubbed.
Yes.
So for me, subtitles, if I'm at home watching something, I'll always put the English subtitles on. I just enjoy following the words to make sure I sort of pick up on everything. But I find dubbing something that interferes with the experience of the film, because you miss the subtlety. Now, of course, I've never been brought up in a dubbing environment as you were, but did it change your understanding of cinema later on, when maybe you watched those same films not having been dubbed? And did you think, oh, that completely changes the meaning?
Yes. I mean, after the end of the dictatorship, when things were more liberal, it was very interesting, because they still continued dubbing. But obviously, they didn't cut out so many things and all this. But then they used to start to do original version films with subtitles. But it was only a minority thing, and it was quite interesting, because you had what they call the X rooms, where you had things that were quite often sexual and all that kind of thing for grown-ups. And when they were in the downtown time, then there would be a showing subtitled films. And I remember once getting into serious trouble because somebody saw me going into the X rooms, and they told my mom, "What is your daughter going to do?" and blah blah blah. And that was, they saw me in the city, and that wouldn't have happened in the village. And they told my mom, "What are you doing? The people think that you..." I was only going to go and see some English film with subtitles. What's the big deal? Yeah. But that's the kind of what we're talking about. Mm.
Can you remember the films that particularly made an impression on you when you were very young?
The Life of Brian. I thought that was amazing. I went back home and I told my parents, "Oh, you've got to go and see this. It's absolutely amazing. It was fantastic, blah, blah." Because my parents went, because they used to, I mean, once a week, they used to go together to the cinema. They went to the cinema, but they came back, and you should have seen my father's face. "What do you think you're doing? Blah, blah." He was livid. But, funnily enough, when I went to Spain, I don't know, I mean, a few years ago, they not only love the film, and they have seen it many times, but they own their own DVD copy. So, just to show you how much things have changed since then, but gosh, did I get into trouble.
Well, the ban was only lifted in some towns and cities in the UK within the last decade. Or in some cases, I think it was in Aberystwyth, it was unclear as to whether the film was still banned, because it was banned in 1979 when it was shown. And it turns out, it's the woman who plays that Brian's wife in the film, I'm not sure, who became in later years, this is such a surreal story, the mayor of Aberystwyth in West Wales. So suddenly somebody said, oh, we must show the life of Brian because, you know, the mayor can visit it. And somebody said, no, but we think it's still banned. And it's like, and then, of course, the BBC, a bit naughty, really, because they then started interviewing people like a local vicar who said, of course it should be banned. It's outrageous. You know, it's so disrespectful. And, of course, it seems so passé, and it seemed as though what may have seemed a really live thing in 1979 was not controversial by like 2008.
That's what I found.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. What about musical influences? Did they play a big part in your life? Were you into contemporary sounds or international music?
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, one of the things that was absolutely critical in my upbringing is that I come from a Catalan community, not a Spanish one. So always, in my family, everybody speaks Catalan, not Spanish. And there's always been this sort of controversy between Spain and Catalonia and all that kind of thing. So what we had was traditional Catalan music, a lot of that. That was another way of actually getting out of the house. They used to do the typical Catalan music is the sardana, which is a popular dance that people dance in a ring. And it's very clever because it's composed in such a way that it's totally mathematical. And if you got the right kind of people, they can listen to the first bars of the song and calculate all the steps that you have to follow, and then you can make the patterns and finish all together at the end of each one of the parts of the song, and then you change the steps and you do another section. So in order to be able to get out and do your own thing, one of the good things to do was to join these groups. And we used to do what they call a black, which was there was a day festival of sardana dancing, and therefore that would mean that then the whole group would be going from here to the next village, to the next village, to the next village, to do your own show dance, and to dance with everybody else, because it wasn't just necessarily a competition. It was the kind of thing where once you knew how to dance, you could join any other group, and as long as you followed the caller, you could actually make it.
And was it intergenerational, or were they just people your age?
No, people of all ages.
Because I remember not a few years ago watching Billy Liar, English film set in the north of England in 1963. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the sort of the Saturday night dance, and it's got all the you know, the employers and the employees, the fathers and the sons, and they're there together with all the different sort of, you know, why weren't you in work on Friday, laddie? You're dancing on a Saturday night, but you didn't turn up for work yesterday. And it was the whole sense of community. Everybody did it together. And these days, I mean, my children are very young, but I can't imagine, you know, a scenario whereby, you know, we'd all be there, you know, dancing in the same barn or the same disco.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think, yes, music, I mean, certainly for us it was very important. We used to do a lot of singing. We used to sing in the choir at the school. We used to sing in the choir in the church. That was the way in which we could actually go up to the choir and not have to sit there and be quiet all the time. We did, obviously every celebration in the village would involve dance in the main square, or they would have the fiestas, and then there would be we call it the Festa Major, the major feast, and they would have marquees and every year. And so, I mean, the things to do, they would do the dance for all the people, and then from about midnight it would be the youngsters only, because all the older people would have gone to bed, and then they change the music and you continue dancing. So the dancing was
does it still happen now?
Yes.
So do you find things very different over in Britain now? Do you feel that there's a sense of community that's lacking? But that sounds like a wonderful way of everybody coming together and really quite literally letting their hair down.
Well, I think that what happens is, my experience anyway, is that in Britain people take up a hobby. And then they are very serious about the hobby. And therefore, then they get all the gear and they do all the things and they go to the lessons. And I mean, I'm doing it as well, because obviously I have been in this country for longer than I have been in Spain. One of the things that I do as a hobby is I dance Argentine tango. And that was something that my parents did at home. But on Sundays, they would either play sardanas, or they would play tangos, or they play blues and jazz. That was the things that were going on at home. And funnily enough, when I started going out here in the UK, especially since about 2005, I started going jiving. But after a while, I just felt that even though I enjoyed it, because I've danced always badly. I mean, I had never been to a dance lesson in my life. I found that the music didn't have any heart in it. It was just like very mechanical. So I gravitated to the kind of music that my parents would play at home. And then I started learning, and of course now that's what my hobby is. But then I can see how people take it very seriously. I just come back this weekend from a tango weekender, and everybody has got all the gear, the right shoes, the right dress, and they are very much, they learn the protocol and they do all the things, and it's also quite a gendered thing, where the women have got to sit and wait for the men to come and ask them and all that kind of thing. And I struggle with that, so I always end up doing my own thing. So I'm regarded as not following the rules. But that is the way I think that English people do it. They want to be able to be really good at something before they try it out. Whilst when I was a child with all this thing, everybody would go and dance and nobody, it wasn't a competition, it was just nobody would judge you because it was the thing that everybody did. You were kind of brought up with it and nobody took lessons.
It's kind of nice though, isn't it, to think that, you know, you want to do something, you may not be good at it. I mean, I used to play pool. I can't play pool, but it was the social experience. And the fluke sometimes when you randomly hit the ball and maybe the red would go in and people would think, oh, how'd you do that? And it was just wonderful because I couldn't play at all, but what a wonderful sense of bringing everyone together and the conversations we'd have around the table and the way sometimes, you know, we were just thinking, trying to process on the one hand the shot, but what we were really doing is just bonding as students. And when I look back, those are some of the best memories I have of just standing around a pool table and, you know, life would, you know, literally, what would be encapsulated in that, you know, half an hour that you were playing, you know, sort of all our hopes and fears and ambitions for the future. And I kind of miss that. And I used to, you know, people would often misunderstand when I'd say that I used to play pool. Oh, you know, how good were you? And, you know, it's like, well, no. It was never about the pool. It was about the people.
Well, I mean, I remember, how do you call it, the thing where you play mini football?
Oh, absolutely. I know exactly what you mean. You turn the different levers.
Yes,
and the ball.
We used to play that. And I used to like, because I was quite a tomboy, and the boys actually, I got so good, they actually were asking me to play with them. And we used to just be loud and have a wonderful time. And temping bowling. The machines where you press the buttons and there was this ball coming down. How do you call it?
Yeah.
The ones that, you know, the ones that have got, you score points, but and they've got a metal ball that is inside the machine with a glass thing. And you play like that, but in those kind of things, at one point they go good.
Yeah.
But I just love that. Prior to that, I used to play football with the boys.
But how did you end up here? How did you end up in academia? What sort of path did you take then from Spain? Was it accidental, or this part of your plan of getting out of the village?
I mean, in a roundabout way.
I want to be in Canterbury, you know, by 1995.
No. What happened was that in the village, the expectation was that when you got to about 20, you'd get married. I went to the secondary school in the city, and when I was just coming up to 18, which would have been towards the end of the secondary school, I started going out with a boyfriend in the village. And he had dropped out of school, and in my family, they assumed that we just going to get married, and but he was not a nice person. I just There was something about him anyway. He settled him on me to continue studying and all this, and I was going to do it anyway. But then I went and said to my father, I wanted to go to university, and I wanted to study philosophy. And my father said, well, why would you want to go and study? I mean, you just get married, stay in the village, and for goodness sake, just don't give us any more hassle. And I said, but I would like to go and go to university. My father left the school when he was 11. Because of the Spanish Civil War, and he had managed to build his business and all that, and he doesn't believe in education. He just says, well, you know, all the people who were clever in my class are now working for me, and he was the one who was failing everything, so there you are. So he said, well, can't you just like study something that is more woman-like, you know? He wanted me to do nursing or whatever, something that was really he saw as a female. I said, well, if that is the case, I'm not doing anything. And that's kind of went on the strike. And at that point, I had just finished my secondary school. I hadn't taken the entrance to university exam, but they called me from the school because their English teacher had disappeared, like given notice, gone. And they needed someone to run their revision sessions for the summer. And somebody decided that I could do that. And so, it was funny because I had studied French in my primary school and I had only started English when I went to secondary, but I found it very easy. Anyway, I went and started doing that. And I thought perhaps this is something that I could do, or I could actually teach English. And that gives me the opportunity, and then I can. So with this, I started taking the certificate of English as a foreign language. And I took them all in 1 year, because you had to do 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the certificate for teaching of English as a foreign language. You could only take it if you have passed. So I did one on the Monday, one on the Tuesday, one on the Thursday. And I did the whole thing. But as I was preparing for that, in one of the lessons that I was going for my English lessons, I said, what I got to do is actually go and practice my English. In fact, I had already been offered a job to teach English in the School of Tourism in Girona. And I hadn't really spoken to anybody. In English, there was, you know, in England, because I had only been here to England as a kid for like 1 month and all that. So she said, "Well, you should go as an au pair." And I said, "Look, I'm up to here with kids, because being the eldest of five, I said, "No, I've got the perfect family for you," because she had been with a family in London that had a dog and a cat that needed looking after, and they just wanted somebody to stay in the house. So I said, fine, I wrote to them, and they gave me the job straight away. You said, can come up next month. So I finished my exams. I went to, I went to London, and I was going to stay July and August, start this job in September. But by the time I got to London, I thought, I'm not going back. This is my ticket out of the country. I'm not going. So I thought, well, what can I do that's useful? And so I said to my father, look, because they thought that I was an embarrassment because I had left a boyfriend and I had done all the things the wrong way, and they didn't feel comfortable about it. I said, well, look, I mean, if you actually pay for it, I found this translation school in London where I can stay and get a ticket, a certificate as a translator, which is going to be good for when I come back, blah, blah. Okay, how much? And so he gave me the money and stayed for a year. And I still being an au pair. And then I thought, well, how can I continue studying but not pay this crazy money of a private school? And I thought, maybe I should try going to university. So I applied, and And I applied to do English literature. But they called me in for an interview and they said, look, sorry, you haven't got any A-level at all. You haven't got an A-level in English. We cannot offer you English. I said, well, can you give me history of art? I thought history of art would be a nice thing. Oh, yeah, but you haven't got an A-level in history of art. Well, then what can I do? And they said, Spanish. And I thought, oh, my God, Spanish, you know. I'm Catalan. My math Spanish was always my worst mark. I hated everything, Spanish, everything. And I mean, I had done actually sciences. I had always managed to pass my courses because I love studying, but it wasn't my sort of thing at all. But it was between I study Spanish or I go back to Spain. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. And I remember that they gave me this poem, medieval Spanish poem, and that was my test. I had to go with this professor of medieval Spanish and give him my analysis of the poem there and then, and I don't know what I said, but obviously I convinced him. So they offered me a place. And then I did my degree at Westfield College in London, which had a very good modern languages department, supposedly. And when I finished my, in the final year, they actually asked me if I could write a letter in Catalan for them to the Catalan government to get a funded lecturer in Catalan at the university to start teaching Catalan literature there. So this person came, and in my final year, I did Catalan special subject, and we did a lot of like Catalan literature and all this. And then, of course, I was finishing my degree, and I wanted to go on studying. So I thought, well, what do I do next? And they said, oh, well, I mean, let's face it, you're going to get the first for this. I said, well, okay. So why don't you do a PhD? Oh, okay, well, how does that work? I said, well, you apply to the European community, and because you got good marks, see how it goes. And they gave me this grant from the European community then, because Spain was still in transition to becoming a full member. They paid for my fees. And at that point, I wasn't sure whether I thought I would quite like to do Latin American studies. But because I was Catalan, and because I thought, well, I got the opportunity, I got all the background, I got the opportunity to go back to Catalonia often and getting materials and things for my research is probably going to be easier. Then I chose to Catalan topic. And I did my PhD in 3 years whilst I had my children. And I submitted something in March. I had a viva and I was awarded the PhD in July, and 1 week later, I got this job.
An amazing trajectory. So it sounds as though it wasn't something that you'd set about doing, but through convergences of, you know, accident, I mean, suddenly you've got this amazing career. But, you know, fell into place.
It couldn't have been further from my mind, yeah. Because certainly, of all things, when I first said that I was going to study, that I was going to be actually teaching Spanish at university, my brother said, I'm never talking to you again. I mean, you traitor. And I thought, oh no. But in fact, actually, I mean, I've been doing a lot of Catalan here since the beginning, so yeah. But that's my
So it was a traitor because of the Spanish-Catalan thing, rather than the fact that you were going to university and therefore more educated.
No, because I mean, actually, because I was the eldest, I had to fight all these battles at home. But then my sister, the next sister down, she studied tourism. I mean, at that time, it wasn't a degree. It was a kind of higher diploma. But she was allowed to do that. Then after that, my other sister didn't want to study. But my brother went into a technical school and studied photography. He's a photographer now. And then by the time my baby sister got to university age, she actually went to real university in Barcelona and studied fine art. And after that, she came to London, to St. Martin's, to do an MA in fine art. So you can see how quickly things change in a matter of 10 years, because that's the difference between me and my sister. And the world was a different place.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I do, because I'm from Wales, even though I only go there perhaps once or twice a year, is always keep up to date with all the developments there in the Welsh Assembly, or, you know, the different places where I lived. And I still find that I gravitate more towards Welsh news than to Kent news, because that's my origin. In your case, do you still follow the political developments in Spain? Are you sort of up to date with that? Or would you say that you've sort of now, because you've been living here so long, do you kind of feel that you've... that you're more, not so much more British, but you sort of feel that this is something that on a day-to-day basis affects you more? Or do you still have that sort of longing almost for the politics? It may also be the religion, I don't know, that you grew up with. You know, if you were exposed to anything religious or spiritual, do you sort of have a sense of anything from what you're doing now, what you did then? Do they in any way sort of converge?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I did when I came to Kent was to set up a course on Catalan culture. That was my first thing. And then after that, it was when we started teaching the language and on and off. But I have never been a teacher of Catalan language. But I've been teaching this Catalan culture course since 1998. So, I mean, it's been a long time. And so because of that, it means that I have been more or less up to date with what has been happening in Catalonia, partly personally, but also partly because I have been updating my materials and all this. And it was regarded as something quite marginal, but obviously in the last few years, since all the move for independence in Catalonia and all the troubles that are still going on now, it has been very important to keep up to date with what has been happening. And in fact, this last time I did vote for the first time, because I've always been outside Spain, and there is all this thing about you have to register to vote, you have to vote by post and all this kind of thing, and I always thought, oh well, it doesn't really matter, I don't live there anyway and all this. But obviously things have become quite serious now, so yes, I am involved, particularly because I can see how it affects everybody in my family, and also because somehow I never know whether I will ever go back. The day they give me a Catalan passport, I'm going, definitely, but I just don't know now. I mean, yeah, this is one of the things, that you have this image of where you belong, and that changes over time, because as I say, I have been living more longer in the UK than I have ever lived in Catalonia. And the people from Catalonia see me as an outsider, and the people from here see me as an outsider. So you are in a kind of no man's land all the time, and you are trying to gauge where you really belong. And in a way, you belong in your own head. You don't belong particularly in any territory. So in a way, I'm probably more pro-Catalan now, after so many years being outside, than if I had stayed there.
No, I think that's really insightful, because sometimes even within, say, Canterbury itself, you will find in certain environments you are much less, you know, within your comfort zone. I mean, that's very much my experience sometimes. I mean, I had an experience the other day when I went into a pub in Herne Bay where I live, and I was very conscious that it was my turn to be served. But then the person on my right, who was shouting the loudest, got served, and he was the third person to arrive after me. The chap on my left arrived after me, and then he got served. And I felt this real sense of, you know, entitlement, but it just sort of like natural justice. It's like, well, hang on a minute, you know, if you're in the supermarket... You know, you form an orderly queue and you get some order, you're there. And I just walked out. I mean, I can't blame the other customer for wanting to get served first, but the bar staff. And I just sort of thought, you know, suddenly walked away just thinking there was something about the dynamics here, and I felt really aggrieved. I thought, you know, there are more things to worry about than getting served in the pub. But yeah, that's the thing. You sort of feel that when you're around sometimes like-minded people, maybe in a university environment, you start, you know, and often when I was at Lampeter as an undergraduate student, there were so many students from all over the world. It was a small Welsh West Wales town, and yet there were students there from the Middle East, from all over Europe, from Australia, from the north of England. You know, it was a complete mixture of people with different cultural backgrounds, and we all sort of came together, and you know, we had in a way, you know, obviously shared interests. We'd all chosen to do degrees in the humanities in one place, and I think you're right that sometimes you can feel very isolated or out of your depth when you're in the same physical or geographical environment that you sort of consider home, and yet sometimes you might travel the other side of the world and feel that you have plenty of kindred spirits around you.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose I've always done my own thing, and I am not the kind. I mean, I don't like routine, and I don't like feeling trapped by something that has to be repeated no matter what. And that is one of the things that I have found, that, you know, I don't, you know, I started playing golf and immediately they wanted me to join a tournament. I don't want to join a tournament because then it means I've got to be here every week. I just want to do my own thing. So, I mean, in a way, it's been a bit like that. And I have close friends, but normally they tend to be on a kind of one-to-one basis, not in a big group. That's the sort of thing. Now, you were asking me about the religious thing, and that's an interesting one, because obviously I was brought up in a Catholic country under a dictator who obviously was very close to the church and got a lot of power out of that. The Catalan Church it was very interesting because on the one hand it was very powerful, but also it was a great defender of Catalan difference, which was something that the government didn't want. But because of their power, they had to actually compromise, and therefore the reason why I'm called Montserrat was because Franco allowed the Catalans in the late 50s, to name their own patron saint. And the saint chosen was the Virgin of Montserrat. And so they built this enormous monastery around what was already an original monastery, but they made it big and they made it official and everything else. And of course, many people of that generation, out of patriotism, Catalan nationalism, gave their daughters the name of Montserrat. And in fact, in my nun school, in my class, there were 21 girls, and 7 of us were called Montserrat. And now, very few people call their daughters Montserrat now, but in those days, it was the rage. Yeah. So then you get labeled this way, because of that, and they were the people who actually had the great big vaults where they kept all the Catalan manuscripts and all the Catalan art artifacts and everything else, and they preserved it from being destroyed. So in a way, and once they the censorship started to ease, they were the first ones to be given permission to start publishing things in Catalan, to start a preaching in Catalan, to do the catechism in Catalan. So all those things were part of the re-emergence of the Catalan language and Catalan culture within the auspices of the church. And, I mean, in my village, there was the nun school, the monk school, and then the state school. But, of course, the government didn't have enough money to pay for schooling for everybody, so they actually, all the teaching religious schools were subsidized by the government, so they worked very closely together. But looking back, I didn't realize it at the time, but my school was incredibly liberal. I mean, we didn't wear uniform, for instance. They decided that people were not wealthy enough to buy uniforms for everybody, so we had just these overalls and just the one overall, and you put it on top of whatever you were wearing, and that would do. I mean, as soon as there was permission from government to start teaching Catalan at school, We were the first ones in, 1972, we started having 2 hours of Catalan a week and 2 hours of French, and then the rest in Spanish. And that was prior to anybody else doing this. So clearly there was an awful lot that was linked to that. Then, of course, I went to the monk school in Girona, and they were not, they were all Spanish speaking. So they didn't have any local monks, they were all imported. But that was, yeah. I mean, but they were more kind of alternative. There was all this movement towards playing guitars, you know, that kind of thing, and being a little bit more distended. And my father, who had started out as a sculptor and then went into steel machinery production, he always worked very closely with his sculpture friends, and the majority of them were people who had been in a hospice in Girona, and particularly his closest friend was someone who was a specialist in religious art, and he just drew virgins and Christs and saints and stained glass windows and all this, all very, very modern. And my father would do the building of the stuff in his spare time when he was not running the company. But those sort of things were very much part of our upbringing. Mm. So yes, we did those sorts of things. Mm. And then, of course, in the summers, the local priest would organize the scout group, and we'd just go out for a month up in the mountains, and we'd do all sorts of things. But again, the ways in which we could get out, we went for spiritual exercises, they called it, and that meant you went for a weekend up in the mountains and had a great time. And yes, okay, we did all those things, and we did a lot of singing, we did masses out in the middle of the woodlands and all that kind of stuff, which was fine, no problem.
Mm. You must sometimes find with your own children just how different your... Because they were brought up, I think, in this country.
Yes.
So you must find sometimes that the difference between what you grew up with and the different experiences, and it sounds like you've had an incredible array of different opportunities compared to maybe them. I don't know if you feel that sometimes there's a disjuncture there. Do you sort of think, gosh, you know, that either they're missing out on something, or maybe it just makes you sort of look back and think,
well,
oh, I wish, I could re-experience all of that.
The thing is, for instance, when they were very little, because I was doing my research in Catalan studies, which turned out to be a good choice, then I would just finish here at the university, go down to Spain, put them into the summer camp, in the same kind of things that I would have done when I was a kid, and they just made their own friends, they learned the language, they went out for little camping trips and all the sort of things that I think I would have been uncomfortable sending them on a summer camp here, because I do not know. But there, it just felt right, and they just go out to the swimming pool and do all the things that, it was obviously a little bit more structured because this was within a kind of organized summer camp. But when they were little, they would just go in the morning and you pick them up in the afternoon, and then later on they just go away to some place and do the same camping. I mean, I thought that it was good that they could share in the things that I had done.
I'm really conscious of how I'm retracing in the footsteps of my parents, just as my parents were retracing the steps of their parents in terms of musical interests, but also in terms of geography. My parents now live in a part of the world where my mum's parents, or my mum's father used to live, and that sense of going back to all the old haunts, I'm very conscious of that. When I visit my parents, there's a whole sense of going around, you know, sometimes literally looking around graveyards, but also looking at the houses that they grew up in, and in some cases seeing that maybe they're no longer houses, but there's that sense of reconnection, and I find that, you know, sometimes when you're really young, you want to sort of be as far removed from your parents as you can imagine. You want to sort of, you know, do your own thing, but you always come back. I think sometimes you can't escape your past.
Yes. Well, what happened was, my relationship with my parents was quite tumultuous, to say the least. But of course, when I had James, I mean, that was what my parents wanted. It was the first grandchild. He was a boy, I mean, that was very important. And I just didn't think that there was any point in me being difficult. You know, it was the kind of thing they really wanted, and I thought I'd just keep quiet. I still have got big disagreements with my parents, but it was none of my business. I thought, you know, this is the grandchildren, and so for the sake of the children, I definitely thought that it was important that they had an experience, and in for them. It has always been a very enriching thing, being part of two cultures, being able to speak the two languages, being able to operate them on their own. I mean, as they grew older, they started just going by themselves. They don't even need me anymore. So, in that sense, it is good.
That pattern is happening. Got one more. Yeah. Sorry,
I was just going to say, and interestingly, James. Decided that he was Catalan as a kid, and he is kind of more English, but he decided he didn't want a British passport. In fact, the only one who's got an English passport is the dog. It was interesting.
I'm conscious that I make myself out to be more Welsh here than I ever did in Wales, in the sense that if I meet a student and I detect them, a few times I have students from Wales, and I'll sometimes, you know, detect the accent. And actually, in one case, a student who graduated last summer actually went to the same school that I did, obviously like 20 years apart.
Yeah.
But suddenly we got this really, you know, we found that we lived in the same part of Cardiff. And, you know, we were sort of talking about the, you know, the shared experiences.
Oh, really?
And that was really bonding, you know, bonding. Okay. So I really feel that sense. I may not sound Welsh, but I'm conscious that I you know, I don't hide, shall we say, that background.
No, I mean, I like meeting other people who are Catalan. But, I mean, I think that, for instance, whilst you have, like, a strong Spanish expat community or whatever, I've never gone for that. It's just no need, because I call my family. You know, they are here. I mean, I can pick up the phone and talk to them anytime, and so that's okay. And also, whilst, for instance, my second sister is very fond of reunions and keeping in touch with people from when we were... I feel quite uncomfortable about all of that. I first of all, I don't remember the people and their stories. And honestly, I'm not really that very interested. It makes me cringe, this whole thing of, like, let's meet up with the people who were in the school, like, 30 years ago. My God, what am I going to say? You know, like...
I'm wrestling with that at the very moment in terms of going back to my reunion. I've got one more question for you, which is, would you say that you were a looking back or a looking forward sort of person?
I've always been looking forward, always. And it is difficult, especially when, you know, life knocks you and you think, blast, you know, where do I go from here? I mean, I don't know whether you heard, but I lost my son this summer. So it's been very tough, and at that point it makes you recap, it makes you think, wow, you know, like, what am I about, where am I going, what's my mission, what can I do that makes any sense, any difference, and I think that it is a danger to look back sometimes. I mean, this is the thing about this nostalgia business, that I think that it is very good to remember and to be grateful for being who we are now. But what I wouldn't want is to live in the past. I think that's unreal. And I am very aware that when you look back, you tend to idealize things. You say, do you remember how awful our lunches were at school? Yes, and how fantastic. I would want to go back and eat those lunches. So I am totally keeping myself in check, I think, by trying to understand that all of that's all very good, and I'm very pleased to have had it, but that I'm still living every day, and that if I don't look forward, then I'm wasting my time. So, no, I mean, I'm definitely a forward-looking person. What's going to happen next, I don't know. But something will, because you see an opportunity and you grab it. And I know that it seems strange looking at a person who's been at this university for so many years. You think, oh, maybe, you know, you stay. But I'm not a staying person. If I manage to exist and still be positive, it's because every time I see another opportunity and I do something else. And one of the things that has been very good for me at the university is that not everything that has happened has been brilliant, but I've been given the opportunity to do lots of different things. So I don't feel stale. I don't feel as though I'm stuck in a place. I keep learning. And I think that is the way to go.
Montserrat, thank you very much.
Thank you.